Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bog live here on DLive.tv/Dave Martell every single Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Unfortunately, we didn't get a show in last week. We had a guest lined up, and there was some confusion with some of the scheduling and whatnot. So, unfortunately, we didn't get the show off. But we got some private content coming. We got some exclusive content coming for the patrons in the next few days here. So keep an eye out for that. That'll be up very, very soon. Like always, make sure to go to Facebook.com/IronAgeJodish and go check out some authentic Vedic astrology. Go get a reading. Do all that good stuff. I'm telling you guys, this is so cool. Not a single person has come back and told me that they were dissatisfied with Mr. Neil John's work. It's absolutely incredible. It'll blow your mind. I'm telling you, it's very, very cool. So go to Facebook.com/IronAgeJodish. And if you decide to get a reading, tell them Big Dave sent you. Tell them Big Dave sent you. Do you love The Bog? You want to help support The Bog? Well, go over to our Patreon at patreon.com/TheBog and go sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. And there's an RSS feed so you can get audio of every single show that we do, plus all of our exclusive content to listen to at the gym, on your commutes, at work, or wherever. So go to patreon.com/TheBog and sign up. Help us keep the lights on, help the ball grow and keep going. And then also, you go over to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and go get some really cool bog merch, man. We got some cool stuff over there. We got t-shirts, we got artisan chef aprons, we got hoodies, we got hats and backpacks and what everything you can think. We even have like coffee mugs and all kinds of cool stuff, man, over there. Just go check it out. Go give it a look. See if there's anything you like over there. If you like it, make sure you take a picture of yourself. Do a selfie, rocking all your sweet bog merch and post it on your social media for everybody. Also, folks, if you just love listening to The Bog over on YouTube or here, well, you know, we do upload all of our shows over there on YouTube. If you love listening to The Bog over there, you want to see The Bog get some more listens, take your favorite episode of The Bog. There's a Bog playlist on my YouTube channel, the Dave Martell YouTube channel. Pick your favorite episode of The Bog, post it on your social media, and tell everybody why you like it. If you're over there watching on YouTube, make sure you like, subscribe, and share over there. So they can beat the YouTube algorithms. We're probably going to get wiped off there pretty soon. It just got demonetized. So we're going to be over here on DLive for the foreseeable future, and unless something else opens up. But there's a lot of content over there on Patreon, so make sure you go check that out, patreon.com/TheBog. Tonight, we are going to talk about something very, very cool, something that's a little bit off the track from what we usually talk about with philosophy and mythology and history and all of these great things. We're going to come into the realm of entertainment a little bit and our opinion and the things that we like to do with our spare time and how we like to have fun and play games and stuff like that. And this episode is called Mythopoetics of RPGs. And what this is about is why RPGs, tabletop RPGs, and tabletop gaming as a whole is so important to us. And not, it's not nerdy, it's not goofy, it's not, so we're going to get into all of this here, but let's get started. Let's see how our guys are doing tonight. Tristan, Andre, how are we doing tonight?
Well, I'm doing pretty good, Dave. I'm finally back after a couple weeks from suffering another bout of COVID, but I'm pretty healthy now. I feel pretty good, so good to go for our show. I'm great.
Excellent. Mr. Andre, how you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing pretty good.
Excellent. So, Mr. Tristan just had his second round of COVID, and we're very, very happy that he's back and he's feeling better and stuff like that. So, nasty stuff going on out there. I hope everybody's happy and healthy and safe going on right now. But so let's get started here. Mr. Tristan, tell us about what RPGs are, tabletop gaming, and why it's cool and fun and wholesome to do.
Right. So RPGs are generally, we'll focus on tabletop RPGs here, are basically you grab books or digital.
Yeah, I think we lost him.
Oh, we lost him. Oh, well. Is that him?
Imaginary fantasy world. So yes, that's me. I'm sorry. My internet is extremely bad today, as I've told Dave. So I might be in and out a little bit. Just try to work with me here, guys.
Oh yeah, we completely lost everything you said. We didn't get a single.
No, not a single bit. Okay.
Not a single bit.
So I was saying that we'll focus on tabletop RPGs here. That an RPG is a physical or digital book you can get full of rules in which you can create a an effectively an imaginary fictional world with your friends in which you can have adventures and game in. And it differs from just imagining things like children would, where they can just make up rules and do whatever they want, because these are systems designed by adults, but oftentimes pretty complex systems, if you really want to get into it, that have structures and rules to make sure that everything is fair. It's, you know, you can't cheat. Everything works exactly like it's supposed to. And it has a, there's a narrative and plot and story and drama between all the players. And generally speaking, it also uses dice in order to determine the outcome of actions. You know, like you roll a specific number of dice and you get a specific number of successes. And if you beat the difficulty of the action, then you succeed.
Yeah. And as you said, there has always been kind of like a little bit of a stigma that it's for nerds or something like that. And I completely reject that, you know.
You know, I would actually say that the stigma on RPGs is something that's really, really out of touch. And it only really applied to like many, many decades ago, like back when D&D came out in the 60s up to maybe the 80s. You know, I've personally been playing RPGs for 10 or 12 years now, and my normal gaming group is the person who runs the game for us and determines all the plot is a former army officer who also worked as a mercenary, and one of the players is his wife. I mean, that's fairly not particularly uncommon. It's not exactly just, you know, Poindexter nerd sitting in a basement somewhere anymore.
Yeah. I wrote this here. I'm going to read this. We're going to talk about my game in this show, because I just invented my own tabletop role-playing game. We're going to get into that, and these guys have read over it a decent amount, and they're going to hit me with some questions and stuff that they liked, and we're going to talk about that. But in this, I have a section talking about what is role-playing, and I'm going to read this here for you. It says, "What is an RPG? For many years, tabletop gaming was considered the pastime of dorks, dweebs, and goofballs, playing a make-believe game while they sit around wearing costumes. In actuality, tabletop gaming is the original organic form of all gaming today. There isn't a single video game available today that doesn't owe a debt to the great Gary Gygax and those like him. Inspired by the mythic poetry of old to create a form of entertainment that immerses the player in experiences akin to the Poetic Edda, the Odyssey, Beowulf, Conan the Barbarian, and Lord of the Rings. Poetry was once written by warriors, and imagination was once believed to be a gift from the gods. Fortunately, the stigma that only nerds play RPGs is melting away as people are now seeing it as a healthier and more fun alternative to the prevailing digital entertainment that has permeated throughout all of modern culture. So grab some dice, brew some coffee, and sit down with your buddies to explore the bizarre and mysterious realms of Grimmearth." And that's what my game is called. It's called Grimmearth. But I wrote this because, you know, growing up, nobody called me a nerd. You know, me and my friends were all headbanger, heavy metal guys. Our one buddy that played with us, he was in the Army. He was an Army guy. We were the kind of guys that if you came and called us nerds, we would beat the shit out of you and take your girlfriend. You know, I mean, we were rowdy country boys from you know, Pennsylvania. We weren't these little goofy nerds. And I'd never, I mean, there's some out there and stuff like that, but this idea that, like, you know, imagination is gay and all that stuff is ridiculous. You know, like I mentioned here in this paragraph, poetry was once written by warriors. That was a warrior's art. You know, poetry, imagination, you know, think about all of the awesome stories and fiction that were written, you know, Tolkien and Robert E. Howard and like all of these, H.P. Lovecraft. Is that stuff gay? Is that stuff corny? Is that nerdy? No. Anybody that comes and tells me Tolkien was a gay nerd or something like that is like, that's fighting words. Tolkien was absolutely a genius.
You know, Dave, as I like to say, you know, the true Aryan people only watch the paint dry.
Oh yeah, that's a whole other thing entirely with a lot of these guys that just like hate fun in general. But instead of playing your sports ball video game and being a slobbering goober that just like buys the same exact identical sports ball game every single year and just sits there and stares in isolation behind a screen killing your brain cells, get with your buddies, pull out these books that have these immense, beautiful fantasy settings that are very much akin to historical settings. This is part of our culture. This is part of our mythos. This is part of our identity, is these wonderful stories and settings and stuff. And what these games do is, number one, they help us, you know, it's a game that helps with reading and comprehension, mathematics. It's great for kids, man. I'm telling you, it's excellent for kids, because you got to read, two, you got to do math, three, you got to hang out with your buddies. You can't do it by yourself. It's a social game, and it's just a lot of fun. It uses your imagination, and it's wholesome. Mr. Andre, are you there, bub?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I had a little bit of a delay.
It's okay. So tell us about your experience getting into role-playing games and why you think that they're good.
Well, I for the personal story here, like, I was never involved in one of the large-scale movements of RPG games and so forth, and most of my introductions to RPGs in general came from video games, and a particular video game that really influenced my interest later in life was Baldur's Gate, which was based on the second edition or third, I think it was second edition of Dungeons & Dragons. Mm-hmm. And that opened up a whole new avenue to me, basically, just seeing a game where you could do all these different things. And then I realized it was based on a real game. However, sadly enough, I wasn't exactly able to get into it, because it was the time before wide-scale internet usage, really, and it was difficult to try and get something like a copy of a rule book when you're living in a really rural area. But as chance had it, we knew somebody who knew somebody who had a USB with a bunch of pirated copies of Dungeons & Dragons 3.5. the 3.5 edition of Dungeons & Dragons. And we were really curious. Me and my cousin, we sat down and we tried running small games with it. And it was just us two. He was the dungeon master as well as a player, and I was just a player. It was a right mess, but it was truly memorable, and it opened up my eyes to what RPGs, like especially tabletop RPGs or pen and paper RPGs, if you will, what you can do here. Because why I think they're so valuable is because it's an organic story that unfolds as you play. There are unexpected twists, turns, and events. There might be massive plot points spread throughout, where, you know, the bad guy does something like this, or this is supposed to happen. But all the other things you are completely able to do in these games. If in Dungeons & Dragons, it's often portrayed like okay, I roll a dice. Do I hit? Yes. Okay, how much damage? 12 damage. And that's it. That's how it's usually portrayed. But there is... I'm not even sure I want to say that there is truly a limit to what you can actually do in a true RPG game like this. You can basically do whatever you want. You can come up with creative solutions, and on the fly, that solution, or at least attempt at solution, can actually result in something. Mm-hmm. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. All of this, all these factors that contributes to this, it essentially means the same adventure is never going to play the same twice. It never is. Mm. And these stories, they start emerging organically, so much so that me and my cousin can still sit down many years later and still kind of reminisce about the times where we played Dungeons & Dragons or Pathfinder, which are the systems I played the most, and these insane stories that followed.
Yeah, and...
There's a couple different gaming styles depending on how your GM or your ST wants to run it. The person running the game for you. One of the styles there is the far extreme, is where they plot everything out. They know what's going to happen to this character at this point, and you're going to go do all these different things, and it's a full narrative story. The one I actually prefer, if I was running games, is I prefer actually the sandbox approach, where I create a setting and then I throw the players in it and I tell them, okay, what do you want to do? What do you want to do? What is your character? You know, what are their ambitions? What, pick anything, really. I can't guarantee that you're going to succeed in it necessarily, but you can definitely attempt anything you wish.
Did you read my part in the core book, the Grimearth core book, where I talk about the difference of GMing, and one of them I call the Maverick, and the other one's the Mastermind?
I don't believe I did personally read that, but yeah, it sounds like Andre did.
Yeah, that's exactly what you're describing there. One GM, he likes to map everything out, every single little thing, and he's like a complete like crafter of everything. And then there's another style of GM that is, you know, he kind of like does it off the top, and you know, and I'm the latter. I like to just do it off the top and let them go and let them do their kind of thing. But what I was going to say, and this is something why I am such an advocate of RPGs, specifically tabletop RPGs, is because me and my friends, when we were growing up, where we grew up and how we grew up, we were from a somewhat of a depressed working class rural area. So, you know, a lot of my friends, I can't think of a single friend that came from a two-parent household. We all came from broken homes. One of my friends, both of his parents passed away, unfortunately, when he was very young. There was like, you know, some of us had parents that were alcoholics, and we were some rough kids, man. We came from some checkered pasts. And instead of going out and getting involved with drugs and getting in trouble with the law, or, you know, just, and we did some partying, like all kids do some partying, but every weekend we got together and we played Dungeons and Dragons and other RPGs. We played many other RPGs too, but we got together and we played. And number one, that kept us out of trouble, and that kept us doing something wholesome and something that was positive. And it made our friendship tighter. And these guys are like still my best buds today, even ones that I don't see. Like I have one of my good buddies, he moved to Texas. I haven't seen him in years, and me and him are still boys. I showed him the copy of my RPG here so he could look it over, and he loves it, and he's like helping me put it together and stuff like that. You know, another one of my boys, I hit him up all the time. We're like another guy, he's in my kindred, and like we're still very, very close. And it's corny, but we had this saying back in the day that when we were playing, we said the bros that roll together roll together. Meaning the friends that roll dice together, you know, roll together, like hang out together. And that was so very true. And that was such an important aspect of my life that really saved me, where, you know, a lot of young men that were of the circumstances that I was went on to go to prison, went on to get into a lot of trouble and stuff like that. And this kept me out of trouble, kept a lot of us out of trouble. And unfortunately, one of our really close brothers that we used to play with, after, you know, everybody grew up and kind of moved away a little bit, he unfortunately fell into drugs and he passed away. And he was like one of our brothers. And actually, I mentioned him in my core book. But yeah, so role-playing games are not nerdy. They're not corny. They're not gay. They are awesome, and they are wholesome, and they are part of our culture as the folk, because they have so many elements and so many aspects and pieces of stories that are part of our ancestral culture. This is a subculture that is ours. That's something that we do. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, I would actually like to touch upon exactly why RPGs are particularly wholesome as well. You see, when you're talking about normal media, you're at effectively the mercy of giant corporations, conglomerates, Disney, Hollywood, studios, that sort of thing, right? And they can make whatever they want, and they know that no one else is going to be able to do anything. You don't have a choice between what you turn on TV. It's all going to be propaganda and the liberal narrative. Whereas if you're doing an RPG, it's you creating the setting, you create what happens, you create your characters, and you create the results of everything. You can make this as traditional and wholesome as your heart content. You can get your children together and make a world full of the best values you have ever wanted to instill into them, if it so pleases you.
Absolutely. You could get all of the clown world stuff that we all oppose. Everybody here listening, everybody here on the panel does not like the goofy stuff that they're doing in mainstream media. And they're forcing it into mainstream media. And what tabletop role-playing gives you is the power to create a form of entertainment, a creative outlet that is completely 100% devoid of anything that you feel is subversive or damaging.
Yeah, and I have to say it too as well that the entire concept of being a GM or a DM, like the one who leads the games, like the you have the resources and you have the tools, especially now in the digital age, to create your entire own fantasy world from scratch and fill it with whatever you want, including the values, traditions, inspirations, or just blatantly just rip off Lord of the Rings and just do that, and just do whatever you want. It might seem daunting at first to even be a player of something like a pen and paper role-playing game, but being a DM seems even more daunting. But I do truly recommend a lot of people to actually try it at least once, both things, be a player and be a creator. Because there is definitely something here to be able to weave your own narrative, to weave your own story, to fit what you think. How does this look in your mind? And they absolutely have the ability to do so.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And real quick, I just want to give some shouts to some of our boys in the chat. Hail Zahn, hail Armor, hail Verbo, hail Healing, hail Bartleby. All you guys, man, I appreciate all you guys. And Verbo says something. He says he has more fun playing RPGs with his boys than he does playing video games. And I agree. I play a little video game. I do. I play video games. We all do. If you're a millennial, you play video games.
If you're under the age of 40, you have played video games as a significant hobby. That's just the way it is.
It's just the way that it is. But it's not as I love tabletop games. I think they're so much better than video games. And I always have said this. My kids will play tabletop games. When people come into my social circles in real life, I'm like, you come over and play some tabletop games. I've had guys. Here's a funny story one time. And this is a little bit degenerate because, you know, of the time of my life, time when I was like, you know, I was probably 20, maybe I was 19. And I was like, you know, smoking weed and partying and doing all that kind of stuff. Well, the one time I was getting ready to head over and play D&D with some friends of mine. And on the way, I stopped to pick up some pot. And I stop at this dude's house to go pick up some pot. And then I get a call from my dude saying it's canceled. Something came up. You know, they had an emergency or whatever. So I wasn't going to go over there. And they're like, hey, you're going to go over there, play Dungeons and Dragons and this and that. And I'm in this room full of guys all smoking weed. It was like a bunch of like jocks type dudes, like kind of yuppie, you know, with the back of the day where they used to pop their collar and dye their hair blonde on the top and like all that kind of stuff. And I'm sitting here in this room with a bunch of guys that probably have never even like heard of what Dungeons and Dragons is. You know, they're the kind of guys that, you know, they all played sports in school and they go and they go to frat parties and stuff. So I'm sitting here with this group of guys and they're like, what is that? You know, because they're all like, you know, they're all smoking weed and stuff. And I was like, yeah, I'll show you. I got some books in my backpack. You can check it out. Just like show them. And I start showing them and they're like looking at the art. They're like, this is pretty cool. Look at this. Blah, 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 you're slaying. Blah. And I was like, you know, if you guys, the one guy's like, can we play? I was like, sure, we could play. I had my whole adventure written up because I was going to DM over there. And we got character sheets. And I taught these guys how to play D&D. And they loved it. They loved it. Like, they'd never even heard of it. And they had so much fun. Some of the guys were, like, really getting into it. Like, they never played at all, ever. It was, like, really, like 10 guys in this group that we played together with. And they loved it. And one of the guys that I was there with, he's still from my hometown, I ran into him, like, actually pretty recently. And he's like, yo, remember that time that you came over? We were all smoking weed and you taught us all how to play Dungeons and Dragons. I was like, yeah. He's like, you still do that? He's like, I was like, yeah. He's like, yo, fuck, I'm willing to come over sometime and play. I was like, so it's like, it was just like a really cool, weird experience that these guys that you would have thought never would have liked it got into it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, you know, some of my personal friends who I've known for years who played RPGs with me have professions ranging from, you know, military, mercenaries, prison guards, that sort of thing. These are, you know, masculine men with families and children and wives and girlfriends and all that other sort of thing. I mean, it's really not uncommon. It's the sort of people who normally play. And really, even at this point in time, a third of all gamers are women. I mean, they're not even particularly underrepresented.
Yeah. And speaking of gamers, we got our boy Suprosity in the chat, and he dropped an ice cream on us. Many thanks, many blessings to you, sir. He's an awesome gamer too. Really, really smart guy. He develops his own games too. But So let's get on to, let's talk about Grim Earth a little bit before we start running out of time. We could go on and on and on all night, how much we love it and our history in it and stuff like that. So let's get into some meat and potatoes. Talk about, we could get into, you guys have some questions for me about my game that's coming out. And then we can get into talking about some of the actual games that we've played and how maybe my game compares to them. And we just chat about some of this stuff here. And a quick rundown for my game. My game is called Grim Earth, and it is a D6 system. It is a little bit different than a D20 system. It's pretty, it's just different. We can get into that if you guys want. We're preparing to do a beta release, a beta print for official game testing, probably in the next 2 to 3 weeks. It will be available, hopefully. And then full release with art and everything, I'm hoping will be out around Yule. So, December of this year, I'm hoping that the full release will be available for everybody. And this is what I'm doing for folks that are helping me with the game testing. For the official release, I'm going to have a price on it. The proceeds from the beta release are going to go to help fund the art, because, man, getting art and everything like this, it's tough. You know, you guys pick up, if you pick up something from like Wizards of the Coast or TSR, maybe like, you know, some of these other companies, they have $1 million studios and teams of artists. And, you know, they, if you go look at the credits in their books, there's like literally like 100 people working on these books. This book is like, you know, right now it's like at 25,000 words. I've written probably by myself 24,000 of it. You know what I mean? I've had some contributions from guys like Tristan and some other folks that are really awesome. And I've had a lot of feedback, and this has been like a really big group effort. It's not just all me. It's a lot of ideas people are helping me with and stuff. But this is what I'm doing. Everybody that buys the beta release is going to be considered effectively a crowd developer. So you get your copy of the beta release. You're going to test it out. You're going to play it. You're going to see. And you can, if there's anything in the rules that you think need to be changed or adjusted or improved or whatever, if you write me an email, and the email address will be in the beta document, you write me an email with the full description of what you think should go in and go get changed or whatever. And if it goes in and it actually, I actually put it into the game, or if I just really, really like your idea, I will send you a free copy of the full release. And those of you guys that are patrons, I will, patrons, I believe I'm going to do $20 and up or something like that. I will send you a copy of the full release. So that's my introduction there.
All right. So,
I was going to suggest that me and Andre just basically alternate between these questions here. We both have the same list, and go through them all, hit them all. So yeah, sure. Would you like to take the first one, or I guess technically it's the second one here, Andre?
Yeah, I can. I just have to say, like, according to what you explained first, though, that your kids are going to play D&D, I'm just going to say Grandpa Dave is going to be lit.
Well, before we get into the questions and everything, I would actually, because you guys have had a good chance to read through most of the content. Tristan's been with me there for like, you know, for a lot of the process, and he's got a pretty good grasp of, you know, what the game is like. If you guys could, in like your words, instead of opposed to mine, explain what the game is like.
Right. I would say the game is almost a very classical adventuring RPG style. It has a lot of influences from D&D.
Did we lose
it?
Grimmer. We'll get it. I'm sorry. What was the last thing you guys heard?
It was the first time you said D&D. It's a very classical adventuring game like D&D.
With lots of influences from D&D. And though I think it's mostly the differences there is the setting's a lot dark and grimmer than most other settings in RPGs like that. They tend to focus on a sort of high fantasy vagueness. Your setting is also, I would say anyway, that it's much closer to a low fantasy setting most of the time, which also presents a bit of a difference between most D&D systems and a lot of RPG systems. But also, you know, we have very interesting influences in the game coming from, you know, what we do is a lot of it is theology and historical analysis and culture and that sort of thing. And, you know, that's something that is lacking from a lot of RPGs. They just sort of, you know, honestly, they kind of half-ass that sort of thing because it's really just not their expertise, right? They're writers and people like that sort of thing. I would say that more or less. So what do you think, Andre?
Yeah, I have to say, like, I agree with most of the points that Tristan made here, that this is a very typical, like, kind of like a adventuring kind of game, but it's also a very I want to classify it as its own thing, kind of like a high-stakes adventuring game, because the things in the Grim Earth here, it's bad. Things are bad. Things are going bad. There is only one place that is truly safe, and that's where all the humans are. That's where you come from. The rest of the world wants you dead, including those horrific river squid that you came up with.
The river squid are definitely our... I guess we could say favorite, but it's really our least favorite thing in the setting.
I like to use them, actually, as a good example here, that this is a setting where everything wants you dead, including the squid that lives in the river. These will jump and bite you in the face until you bleed to death. This is what the type of world that we're dealing with. It's a world that would... that is... things are... as I said, things are going bad, but, you know, there is still... my impression that there is a glimmer of hope if people are brave enough and if they are tough enough and if they are skilled enough to go out into this literally untamed wilderness that is teeming with all these demonic and unnatural beasts and animals that wants you dead, mutilated, and more, to go and recover and discover and find new things to bring back to make sure that humanity's survival is ensured. That's why I want to classify it as a very high-stakes kind of survival, I guess, survival exploration adventuring game. That's how I would want to summarize it.
Yeah, I think those are very accurate. And Tristan touched on the theology aspect. To really, really understand the totality and flavor of the setting itself, you do have to open the page that talks about the mythos and understand how the world works, because that is what really defines the world, is the theology, the metaphysics of the greater universe, of the cosmos, and all of that stuff. Even though the overwhelming majority of the population that live in Grim Earth are completely unaware to it. They have no idea anything. It's only for, like, the most learned priests and stuff understand this kind of stuff. And one thing that I wanted to really illustrate is, you know, as Tristan said, a lot of modern fantasy games are, they run into the problem of they're just writing more fantasy on earlier fantasy that's on earlier fantasy, and then the guy that knew about actual history and theology is six generations back, and they're so separated and far from them. So I'm a guy that I'm not an expert, I would say, but I am a guy that is very, very familiar, and I know what I'm talking about when it comes to history and theology. So I wanted to base a world that still was not necessarily a reflection, but was inspired and accurate to how things were in actual history and actual theology that actual people believed, and not just some like building fantasy upon fantasy upon fantasy for six generations and six incarnations of the game. So in this game, the overarching theme is that effectively there was like a great cataclysm. There was a great like apocalypse thing, and everybody had to get on a boat and leave the continent that they call the motherland, which is effectively Europe. And they left, and they landed on this very large island. Well, not an island, a small continent. And this small continent, they cannot leave for some reason. Well, the reason that they can't leave is because the way that the cosmology works is when a layer of reality gets to a certain size, it breaks off and starts to drift towards what's called the Mysterium. And on the outsides of the cosmology, there is what's called the Mysterium. And it is this vague place of just like shifting thought forms and broken fragments of memories, and it's just like just weird nothingness. It's called the Mysterium, or it's also called the Dream Sea. And these pieces of these realms, these material realms, break off and drift further and further into the Dream Sea until eventually they become so abstract and melt into the immaterial that they eventually just dissolve and vanish and become part of the Dream Sea. So they are drifting on Grim Earth, meaning that they are on a grim version, a grim fragment of Earth, and they are drifting into the Dream Sea as things get weirder and more nightmarish, and there's no escape. And they live huddled together in this very large walled city that's protected by like divine magic called Mannheim, home of men. And they one thing I wanted to illustrate in this world was one of the problems that people, writers, in my opinion anyways, is they have a universal ultimate good that fights a universal ultimate evil. And in my world, it's no such thing. There are many, many different factions and institutions and alliances of different intelligent creatures and beings and also just monsters that are just all competing for against each other. So there's like, there'll be like this group of monsters, intelligent monsters, and this group of intelligent monsters, and they war against each other and not just against all against humans. So it's a very chaotic kind of social ecology to the entirety of the setting itself. So that's kind of like a rundown. So picture 16th, 17th century people. Christianity in this world never happened. They remained pagan, and they were pagan to the point that they centralized paganism. And it was like, it's like if paganism blended with the medieval Catholic Church, and that is their religion effectively. It's polytheist. It's kind of like, you know, druids, and they do psychedelic stuff. They have dream quests, and they do all kinds of, you know, creative spiritual things, but they are a cohesive institution with heresies and blasphemies and stuff like this, and they have political power as well. So before I yak on for too long, I told you guys this would happen, but let's go with the questions then.
Okay. To start off, it's more of a pragmatic, practical question here. It's, where you can go online and search up tabletop RPGs online, and you can basically find 10 separate systems altogether that you can download for free and so forth. What exactly inspired you to come up with the game and the setting itself?
Well, a couple things. The game itself, I am not happy with the direction of modern RPGs. You know, we call it pause. Everything is getting paused. I wanted to create something that I could protect from pause, that some, you know, 14-year-old, 15, 16-year-old could pick up and start playing and not have these like really degenerate ideas and narratives normalized in his game. First and foremost, that's what I wanted there. And then another thing that inspired me is I wanted to do something a little bit different. I feel that a lot of times, a lot of these settings and mechanic systems and stuff have gotten a little bit stale over the years. Not that there's anything wrong or bad with them, but the people that are using them and writing around them and stuff, they, like I said, they're just kind of writing fantasy on fantasy and on fantasy, and they're not really doing anything fresh and new. So I wanted to see if I could create something fresh and new. And what inspired me really for the setting was I wanted something unique. And there's not a lot of games out there that are set in the 16th, 17th century, which is the time we're talking about, like the time of the Pilgrims and the Puritans going through the Age of Sail and getting into... This is a really... For me, this is a really fascinating time. I'm sure Tristan's going to ask me about technology, but this is a very fascinating time for technology because this is during the advent and also the popularization of widespread issue of gunpowder weapons. This is when you had your first muskets. This is when cannons were in larger production, and their production and their styles were very diverse, and it wasn't standardized yet. So you had cannons, and you had explosives, and you had very archaic weapons, but you also still had knights in shining armor that were still effective on the battlefield. You had guys that were pikemen. It was like the new technology of guns were just coming in, but they weren't good enough to replace the technology of antiquity, which was metal armor, metal weapons in your face, cutting and stabbing and bashing, and horses and like all of that stuff. So that's what really inspired me. I wanted to take those things, mash them up, and create something new.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds absolutely excellent to me. I'll go down to the next question here. So, Dave, what are the primary influences upon your work? I know when me and Andre were looking at it, we came up with the idea that it has a lot of influences from Lord of the Rings, Warhammer Fantasy, and Conan primarily, for at least from our eyes. What do you think is the primary influences?
I am not very well versed in Warhammer Fantasy. So I've played like what's the game sort of like Left 4 Dead but Warhammer Fantasy,
Vermintide.
Yeah, Vermintide. And I like that game a lot, but I never really got into Warhammer Fantasy. We had a discussion about this a few days ago. It's not really my flavor. There's people out there that really love it, and it's a very well-done, fleshed-out setting. It's just not something that I draw influence from. Lord of the Rings, absolutely, certainly. I cannot create something without a little bit of Tolkien bleeding through. And you also mentioned Conan. And yes, absolutely Conan, because I have one thing I absolutely love about Conan, not just the world and how grim and barbaric and badass it is, but also he fights things that are like real life. Like a lot of times Conan is fighting against these archaic proto ape men, like these, like, you know, hairy bipedal ape men that, you know, evolution left behind these powerful missing links. And I love those kinds of monsters that you can really visualize, because there was a time in history, you know, according to scientists, that, you know, the early humans, the early Homo sapiens, were competing against, you know, Homo florensis, competing against Anthropithecus and Homo erectus, and all of these different species of proto man were all fighting and warring and killing each other. So I love that idea of having weird, unevolved humanoids in there. But in addition to Conan, this is Robert E. Howard. His other big character that gets slept on a lot, they had one movie about him, Solomon Kane. Solomon Kane was a huge influence with creating this setting, because Solomon Kane, his setting is so cool and dark and weird, and Solomon Kane is such an interesting badass character. He fights witch doctors and demons and vampires, and he's effectively, he was a bloodthirsty, greedy pirate. He was effectively like a Blackbeard type character that repented and became religious and pious, and now has to fight demons, and he deals all his guilt and self-loathing, and he's absolutely vicious, and it's just so cool to see those things mixed with people wielding rapiers and cutlasses and having like muskets, like shooting vampires with musket balls. That mashup was so cool to me. I just had to give Solomon Kane some more love.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. Know, that's interesting.
That is very interesting. I didn't see Solomon Kane in it, but as you describe it, I mean, I'm familiar with Solomon Kane. I could definitely see how the influence was coming from that.
Yeah,
I will admit I am not familiar with Solomon Kane at all. I am familiar with Conan, however.
And another influence, real quick, obviously, H.P. Lovecraft. And I really, really like lost civilization stuff. So another influence on me for this, it's not fantasy, it's not fiction, but stuff like Graham Hancock. Ideas that there are like Hyperborean and Atlantean antediluvian worlds that are long lost. Because that's another piece of this game, is that they completely forgot and lost everything that they used to be. And they piece it back together by searching these ruins of this lost civilization that was on the continent. And they soon find out that these ruins on this continent are the like forefathers of them. And they like piece themselves back together from these like 10,000-year-old ruins of these people that are just completely long lost. So there's that in there too.
Okay. Would you, in that case, like, as you said, like, you were not familiar with Warhammer Fantasy, would you say that there is at least some inspiration, partially at least, from Warhammer 40K?
Yes, that's definitely a thing. The idea of having a singular group of humanity that is fighting against the forces of nature and these demonic entities and these like the monsters are almost like the Xenos, and there is a class, like a playable character class in there that I envision to be the 16th century version of the Astartes, and that is the Tavarian Legion, and their whole job is to go out and exterminate as many of the monsters and denizens of Grim Earth as possible before they die, and that's all that they do.
Okay, I guess I guess we can like move on to the next question. And so, in your own words, then, would you describe your game as a high fantasy game, low fantasy, or a sword and sorcery type of game?
Low fantasy. I would say it's some people would argue with me because it does have magic in it, but it is like the highest. It's like the higher end of low fantasy. I wouldn't call it sword and sorcery. You know what? Maybe it is sword and sorcery. It kind of falls in between those two things. It's certainly not high fantasy.
All right, I think that's pretty good. And yeah, you know, I was wondering that myself, if it's sort of sword and sorcery almost applies like 75%, and then maybe the rest is like low fantasy. But it honestly, your setting seems like one of those settings that the amount of fantasy level is dramatically different based on where exactly you are in the setting and what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, for example, there's not really anything that you're going to come into contact with in the world that you can't kill. A lot of magic is very... Sword and sorcery, one of the defining elements of that kind of genre is magic is very mysterious. You know what I mean? It's not like high fantasy. You have wizards and sorcerers and all these people study magic. There's a magic shop on every corner and blah, 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 blah. In my setting, magic is very, very guarded. It is very, very regulated. If you play a spellcasting character, it's considered taboo and high blasphemy to practice offensive magic. Like to throw fireballs or to like siphon people's lives or necromancy or any sort of like offensive magic is considered taboo. So all of the other magic is either healing magic or some type of indirect stuff. So it's not like that. And the rest of the magic that is offensive is very mysterious. They don't know how it works. It's spooky to them. And there's even stuff in there that they can't discern whether or not it is magic or if it's some weird technology. There's a lot of question marks around the magic in my system. And it's not as common. Only a very select few can control and cast magic. And the magic that they do cast is very, very selective. The setting itself is mostly martial. So I would actually say, yes, it is sword and sorcery.
All right, well, that's pretty fair. Let's go on to the next question here. Can you talk about the tech level of the game? It has access to gunpowder weapons, but what kind of historical sources are we looking at here? What sort of time periods were you most influenced by, and how does that actually affect the mechanics of the game?
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, 16th, 17th century. We're talking about the 1500s, 1600s, and maybe even like it's like that... 200, those couple centuries right there. Let's say like 1580 to 1710 is like the technology era that we're looking at here. Maybe a little bit earlier, 1600s and stuff like that. This is the time period that you had like the Puritans and the Pilgrims, but you also had a lot of wars and stuff that were fought during this time. Europe was completely enveloped in war at this time, and this was who would have thunk it? Because this was the time that militaries started issuing muskets. You had this is the time of musketeers. This was the time of sailing privateers that had cannons on their ships. This was the time that they had started to innovate and create different types of cannon artillery, me and Andre and all of us were talking about a couple days ago in the chat. We talked about how they had chain balls and they had all kinds of different unique things. They had blunderbusses, which were like archaic shotguns. They had all of this different kind of stuff. So that's the time period that we're looking at. And a lot of the sources that I looked at were some of the Napoleonic Wars, some of the wars that happened around Switzerland during that time, because the Swiss were very, very big on pikemen. They had like some of the best pikemen, and they had some really great battle techniques. They would send cavalry. They were the first ones to really, instead of using like horse archers and having just standard cavalry, they had cavalry musket men. So their formations was they would have pikemen, and then they would have coming around the flanks and coming around and just firing balls. They would send guys wielding musket pistols or muskets. So they would go, they would have two musket pistols in their sash. They would come around their horse, bop, bop, and they would come and they would turn back around. And this was hell to deal with for their opponents because they're getting hit with musket balls from all of these guys that are just riding away out of their range. So it was like, you know, there's quite a few different wars that we're looking at, and quite a few, it was just that's the time period, and those are the kind of the sources that we're looking at.
Interesting. It's very similar to what you said before, though, that this was an interesting age for both a cultural shift, but also a really interesting age for technological development, especially in the aspect of gunpowder weaponry, where it was absolutely a wild west of different types of technology, as we discussed extensively in some of the chats, like with different types of matchlocks, dog locks, wheel locks, and so forth, all these different types of gunpowder-powered weapons and so forth. So, absolutely, that is, in a gameplay setting, I don't think I can recall any setting which this has been done, especially in a fantasy setting.
Yeah, that's something that I always thought was, this is a time period that there's not a lot of fantasy around. You know what I mean? So I wanted to kind of take a time period that is a really cool, fascinating time period that has a lot of stuff and can still work mechanically, because as we said in the chat, you know, once you start introducing the Gatling gun and you start introducing some of the more advanced gunpowder weapons, repeating rifles and so on and so forth, it changes. The moment those come out, the knight in shining armor is gone. So I wanted to have both worlds. I wanted it to still feel fantasy with your plate mail and your swords and your maces and your shields and all that stuff, your crossbows, and but also I wanted to have the musketeers, the guys that shoot and load and do all that kind of stuff. So I just thought it would be unique and different.
Okay, so moving on to the next question in that case. Can you give a brief explanation for what is the cultural inspiration behind the Foundlings, those first and only humans on this continent?
So the Foundlings are a Germanically inspired sort of Anglo. They're like if you know, Christianity never happened, and paganism, mainly Germanic paganism or Germanic heathenry, sort of became a centralized cultural mainstay among all of Northern Europe, and that kind of developed. And there's also some influence. It's kind of like a strange mashup of all of these different cultures, but language, as far as the language that is in the book, is heavily, heavily Germanically inspired. The religion is very heavily Germanic inspired. However, a lot of the culture and the clothes and stuff like that are very Saxon in nature, or Anglo-Saxon in nature. So there's not a lot of, I can see a lot of Slavic kind of stuff. It's very Northwest Europe.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very standard fantasy genre to go in, but I would say the main differences here is that as people who are very well versed with this sort of thing, we can generally do it much better and more authentically in Grim Orth than you would see in other generalized fantasy staples.
Mm-hmm.
But we're actually going to talk about some of the things we're most interested in here. What is the religion of the Foundlings, and what are its inspirations?
So, real quick, who the Foundlings are. The Foundlings are what the humans in this realm call themselves. Foundlings. They are the children of the Founders. And the Founders were the first people to land on this continent when they fled the motherland. So that's why they call themselves the Foundlings. And there's also a lot of they organize themselves in houses and clans, and the highest, they're called sire clans or sire houses. The sire houses are people whose patron that founded the house have direct lineage to the motherland. And from there, there are what are called lesser houses. And the lesser houses are those who have splintered off and made, other houses, but they're no longer part of the five founding houses. So it's like sort of like a Gangs of New York mafia kind of thing inside the city as well. So there's a lot going on in this setting. It's not just here's where the people live, we're individualists. And that's another thing that I don't like about a lot of modern fantasy, is they kind of just transport modern worldviews and lifestyle and everything into these fantasy worlds, and it's just not authentic. As Tristan said, we're guys that are well versed in history. And
I'll tell you what, Dave, what you just described is exactly how you get me volcanically mad.
Oh yeah, just like this individualism kind of stuff that they It's effectively just like liberalism fantasy with swords and armor and dragons. That's what they do.
I mean, I'm not super autistic about making all of my settings make sense sociologically. And so when you introduce like liberal beliefs about things and then put them into a medieval setting, it doesn't work. None of these people should believe any of these things based on how they live. Catastrophically angry.
Like, I'm not entirely sure I agree, because certain things like proto-liberalist ideals did exist in the medieval world.
Like things like property rights. Things like property rights and free enterprise and
When we're talking about like this sort of thing, I'm not talking about like political liberalism as a generalized category. I mean like SJW shit, effectively.
Yeah. And also just individualism as a whole. In my setting, I really give you a taste of what it was like in ancient times, and even up until fairly recently, that when you identify as a collective family. You are a clan, an amalgamation of family units that identify together. And they, like, it's not like regular role-playing games that if you're just an individual and you just walk in anywhere and insult anybody or steal from anybody. It's not like an Elder Scrolls game. If you go into a bar and you offend the wrong person, that has repercussions for your entire family and their reputation or their economic endeavors or their livelihood or even their safety. You know what I mean? There's certain groups of guys, certain houses that if you insult them, they might kill your mom. You know what I mean? You insult some guy's wife or something. They see your mom walking down the road, they'll walk up and shoot her in the head to get revenge on you. They'll do drive-bys and just blast people with muskets. They'll burn your house down. They'll call their boys that are also doing business with you, and they'll stop doing business, and then your family has no business, and now it's all your fault. So there's a lot of like collective repercussions in if you live in the city of Mannheim, which is the city of the Foundlings.
Well, in that case, I would say that kind of makes sense, especially from a dramatic perspective, that if you offend someone's honor, your entire family's honor has been put on stake, and it's fair game for them to just absolutely blast your entire lineage asunder.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about it before on the program that one of the reasons modern Scandinavians have a culture of not rocking the boat is because our ancient ancestors lived in a culture and a setting in which pissing off the wrong person might get your entire family inside of a blood feud.
Yeah. Like, I'm not going to pull the Scandinavian card too much here, but like, I can say for certain that's still a thing that applies. I guess on this note, though, we can move on to the last question. I think this is going to be a pretty hefty one. I see that we're going a bit over time, and I think it's worth it. And I would say, what do you want to describe the game itself, entire setting? Would you describe it as a noble bright, or a grim dark, or a syncretic grim bright setting? And so, I should, like, I guess I explained a little bit that Warhammer was the one who kind of coined the term. Warhammer Fantasy and Warhammer 40K coined the term grimdark, where everything is absolutely horrendous, everything is shit, everything is going badly, and there is absolutely no hope. Your death is inevitable, and your death is not going to be the last. Your death is going to result in you going to the afterlife to be eaten, devoured, tortured by demons for all eternity, more or less.
Yeah, so the question before that was religion of the Foundlings and its inspirations. I can just answer that in like 1 second. The religion of the Foundlings and its inspiration is heavily Germanic and Indo-European inspired polytheism. That's it. There's nothing really too far outside of that explanation. But the cosmology and the eschatology are super important when understanding why this setting is either noble, bright, or grimdark. Because when you play this setting, at first glance, you'll be like, this is a grimdark setting. Because, you know, as Andre said earlier, everything wants to kill you, everything wants to eat you, everything wants to possess you, everything wants to corrupt you. There's that survival is bleak, it is hard. Even just like the combat settings and the mechanics, it's not like D&D. When my friends come over and we play Grim Earth, It's like if they're new to this game and they're from something like D&D, it's like, come on, Cream Puff, welcome to boot camp. This is a game where every single battle could be your last. Combat is very realistic. It's very brutal. It's very fast. It's a lot of fun. It's very exciting. But it's also, it's not like D&D where there's these big bloated health points and they walk into a room. There are 8 skeletons. Time to fight the skeleton. No, those 8 skeletons are probably going to roll you unless you can figure out a way to get advantage on them. You use every advantage to your, use every sort of thing to your advantage. Environment, cover, strategy. There's a lot of different strategic maneuvers in the battle. There's a lot of different weapons loadouts. The technology that you use in this game is incredibly important because different weapons and different armor are effective against different targets and different people. And so you're going to have different weapon loadouts. You're going to experiment with different weapon loadouts, have different abilities and stuff like that. You're going to carry multiple loadouts. You're going to make sure you have a well-rounded party of people that do different things. So no matter, depending on the encounter that you have, you could be like, okay, let's use this strategy. This is not a game where you could just like roll your way out of things. You have to use your brain. You have to use strategy. You have to use cunning, or you will die. You will not make it if you don't use strategy. Now, as far as whether it's Grim Noblebright or Grimdark, the reason I brought up about the religion is the cosmology and the eschatology are 100% necessary to understand if we're going to answer that question. Because you mentioned 40K, and 40K, their slogan is Grimdark. In the grim darkness of the far future, there is only war. You know, I mean, that's 40K. Now, since then, every sort of Grimdark setting that has come out has been effectively a carbon copy or a cheap thrift shop ripoff of 40K. I wanted to take the essence of 40K and do something a little bit different. Yes, it's grim, and yes, it's dark, but it doesn't have to be everything amoral, everything painful, everything suffering. If you go into the city as a whole, the city is mostly a moral place. It is mostly a place it's a pretty safe place. Besides the street wars and the beef between houses, you can walk down the streets in this city and be safe. There's not a lot of crime. People really care about each other. It's not a bad place to live, except for every other week the bell goes off and there are monsters at the gates trying to murder people. And there's weird ethereal monsters that get in and terrorize people. And there are everywhere you go is just really, really hard. There are people that live out in the wilderness and stuff like that and travel and do these things. But to travel and to live in the wilderness of this setting is it takes the brightest, it takes the toughest, and it takes the most cunning. And even them, they sometimes die. So it's you know, on top of all of those things, you look at Mannheim, the city as on its own, it's not that bad of a place outside of all of the external things. Being in a human in Mannheim under the rulership of Mannheim is a pretty decent place. However, what keeps it a grim, dark setting is the inescapable reality that most people don't know about is that they are drifting towards their doom. They will inevitably be dissolved and dematerialized and turned into some weird, abstract, immaterial thought form. There's no escaping it. They cannot leave this continent. They cannot leave this realm. There's no going back, and they're here until they are destroyed. And they don't know whether it's going to be next year or in 10,000 years. They can't tell. So that is why it is a grim, dark setting on top of all of the really, really gruesome and nightmarish external threats that exist.
So you would say, like, there is like a faint glimmer of hope, but there is that glimmer of hope is ultimately irrelevant. It's fake.
It's an illusion.
Okay, I guess that answers the question that this is indeed a very grim, dark setting.
So we've brought this up on the show a lot. I love the paradox of the simulation theory, that if it is a simulation, you should just act as if it is not a simulation, because to you and your experiences and what you think and feel and experience in the simulation feel real, so you might as well act as though it is real. And in Grim Earth, your doom is impending, but all of reality around you is descending into abstract nightmares and bizarre realities, and like there's a lot of really weird Lovecraftian cosmic psychological kind of stuff going on with this setting too. So it's like, despite everything, you might as well try to be good. And that little bit of time that we do have left in Grim Earth, we should act as though we do have a future.
It sounds like they really need to get their shit together to build a rocket ship and get back to real Earth.
Well, if they take a rocket ship, they go out into the Mysterium.
Yeah, but at least they're going in the right direction, right? Like they're going back towards reality. Like, they've already passed through this, all the weird shit.
I'll tell you what, I have been kicking around the idea of one day expanding into what could be like a Spelljammer or Planescape type of thing where people can travel through the realms. And then I think that kind of takes away the really gruesome charm that goes with being absolutely trapped in an inescapable material, semi-material nightmare.
Oh, it would definitely be an entirely different game and genre. I'd have to say that, yeah.
Very cool. So overall, what do you guys think about everything?
Well, you know, I'm very interested to start playing Grim Earth and participate in a game there. I think it'll go out very great. And, you know, we'll fix some of the issues it probably has. There's, you know, never perfect when it comes up. But, yeah, I'm very excited. It looks great to me.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah, I have to agree. Like, it's a unique and solid setting. So I'm definitely excited to try it out myself.
As I mentioned earlier, a lot of people probably aren't. Grim Earth might not become their standard because everybody's just so set in medieval fantasy, and most people are going to go back to playing D&D as their standard. But I really wanted to create a viable, unique alternative to play, and maybe it does become people's standard, and maybe someday 16th, 17th century fantasy will become the standard. Who knows? But to say what I said earlier, folks that might have missed it, the beta print will be available. It's not going to have any art. It's going to be very rough. It's not going to have everything. It's not going to be full release. This is going to be for official game testing, and all proceeds from all the profits that go from this are going to go into funding a lot of art and stuff like that for the full release. So those of you that buy the beta release, the beta print, and help me game test, I will have in there, will tell you about those of you that do play and you find problems with the mechanics or the gameplay or whatever, or you even just have some ideas that'll make the game better, type it up, send me an email. If it goes into the full release and it fixes something that isn't there, because like I mentioned earlier, it's like 20 something thousand words. I've written probably all but 1,000 of the words. So it's all one man team. I'm doing most of this. So it's not like, you know, Wizards of the Coast where they have, you know, literally 100 people all working on it. It's just me. So there's probably going to be some bugs in it. So for those of you that are out there and you want to help me fix these bugs, write me an email. And if it goes in, or I just really, really like your ideas, I'll send you a free copy of the full release. I'll send you a free copy of the full release. Ancestral Weapons donates one ice cream. So, yeah, that's it. We are 10 minutes over time. Do you guys have anything to say in conclusion?
You know, I think I've pretty much covered everything we're going to talk about here, so I'm good.
Very cool.
Mr. Yeah, I think we covered most of it.
Very cool. All right, guys. Well, I appreciate you guys hitting me with these questions and your interest. And, man, these guys have been so awesome helping me put this damn thing together. I've been ripping my hair out and, like, working on this tirelessly like a madman for weeks.
You know, I do have to say, Dave has been the most productive person ever. He's basically written, like, an entire book's worth of material in like 2 or 3 weeks.
Dave has been a fucking machine.
It's been, I appreciate that, man. It's I put a lot of work and a lot of love and a lot of thought, and this is the setting and like the mechanics or stuff that I've been having in my head for years and years. And I finally sat down and I said, no more just half-ass writing things that just go into a notebook. I'm going to print something and create something that even if it flops and people don't like it, at least I finished it. So this, I sat down and I said that, and I got obsessed with it, and I got into it, and I tapped into the, I really tapped into the poetic inspiration for this. I really, really did, and the ideas were flowing, and it was a lot of work, and I hope everybody really enjoys it, and I hope that, I hope it kicks off and people have fun. But anyway, thank you, Mermaid, for the diamond. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. This will be the beta print will be available in the next few weeks, hopefully, and we'll go from there, man. Stay tuned. Next week we'll be back with more regular Bog style content, and just keep your eyes peeled. I'll have something on YouTube. I'll have something on Telegram. I'll let you guys know when the stuff's available. So many thanks, many blessings. We're gonna raise the horn. I actually don't have the horn tonight, unfortunately. I forgot it. So I'll raise my bottle of water because Big Dave is drinking water and trying to. Get healthy and stay healthy. So we're going to raise a very healthy bottle of water to our most beloved exalted patrons. That is going to be House Allen, as we Mr. Corey, and our very own Andre. Many hails to them. Many blessings to them. And many hails and many blessings to each and every one of you. I'll see you guys next week, Friday at 9 p.m. Eastern, here on the Bog, DLive.tv/Dave Martell. Hail and good night.